Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the week in review, including the aftermath of a lynching-style attack in New Hampshire.
He swung back and forth a few times. My niece was screaming. She was obviously quite shaken up. Luckily, it was not tied well, and he was able to free himself.
Also today, a conversation with the state official who just levied the biggest campaign finance penalty in Massachusetts history.
You know, money's like water. It's going to go somewhere. And our job is to make sure that everybody knows how it got to where it's going.
And David Foster says for thousands of years, both people and nature have inexorably changed Martha's Vineyard.
This kind of beach disappears overnight. So it's completely ephemeral. Water washes it away and nothing.
But what does that mean for the island's future? That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we'll begin our Friday Week in Review with the disturbing allegations of a lynching-style attack in Claremont, New Hampshire, on an 8-year-old boy. Here's the boy's uncle, Lyric Merlin.
He swung back and forth a few times. My niece was screaming. She was obviously quite shaken up. Luckily, it was not tied well, and he was able to free himself.
Now, no adult witnessed what happened. The boy's mother, Cassandra Merlin, says it was a racially motivated attack.
The fact that my son was biracial and these boys were of white descent.
Claremont, New Hampshire Police Chief Mark Chase is not discussing details of the case because everyone involved is a juvenile, but here's what he told CBS News.
I have faith that my officers are doing everything and anything they can to further investigate this little boy's injury.
The town of Claremont rallied against racism and hate on Tuesday, but NHPR reporter Brita Green said even that rally was marred by controversy.
The event's organizer, Rebecca McKenzie, was just introducing the night's first speaker when she was interrupted by a white man driving by and yelling from his truck. All lives matter, he proclaimed, responding to Black Lives Matter signs in the crowd. Stop making it about race, he said.
Well, there is much to discuss today, and joining us now to do so is Jennifer Nasur, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. Jennifer, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond. She's a minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Reverend White-Hammond, it's good to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with you, Reverend White-Hammond. I mean, the story from Claremont, New Hampshire, we should say the alleged attack happened at the end of August.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually, part of the story is that it took a while for the rest of us to notice that it happened. Mm-hmm. But so just, you know, what's your first thoughts?
Well, you know, I think what's most concerning to me is obviously that these are children. I heard a quote, you know, children don't come up with this on their own. How would you even know the word lynching unless you would have been exposed to it somehow? I'm really concerned that something that a lot of us have said for a while is that the rhetoric has gotten so bad
mm-hmm.
at the sort of top and highest levels that at some point that begins to filter down. And it's really sad when that filters down to our children. So I don't want to comment on everything because I think there are many details to still come out. But having read a number of articles, what I read already is highly disturbing. And so the question is not just what happened, but how will we respond to
right.
it? And yeah, it's also a little concerning that it took this long for people to even hear about it. I think, you know, for the school administrators there, for people who are running after school programs or Boys and Girls Clubs or any kind of, how are children being helped to process this?
Right. And we should say that the sister of the little boy who was allegedly attacked goes to school with one of the other young people who is alleged to have participated
yeah.
in the incident. So it's a small community, and it's just complicated and hard on so many different levels. Jennifer, what's your thought?
So I have to say, as a parent, you know, that's I go back to exactly what you said, which is, kids don't just come up with stuff on their own. It's what you are taught at home. It's the level of respect that you are brought up with. Mm-hmm. It's your parents' own beliefs. And I think, you know, that guy that was driving by during a vigil, like, that's fine. Yes, all lives matter. I agree. However, it was a vigil for an 8-year-old boy who that should not have happened to. And, you know, I think that we live in a world right now where political correctness has gone out the window for we can just say anything we want to say and we can behave any way we want to behave. And I find something personally wrong with that, especially as a mom trying to raise kids today and to say, you know, not only say please and thank you, but hey, be nice to people.
Right.
Like, just be nice. Be a good friend. Be a good person and ignore all the other stuff that goes on. And I think that really that starts at home. I don't know how we change it unless people, adults, are willing to change themselves.
Right. Yeah. And I think this piece around just there's some basic manners.
Absolutely.
There's basic. You can disagree with people without attacking people. You know, every day I interact with people that we don't have the same opinion. Even in my own house, my husband and I don't like to load the dishwasher the same way. But there are ways to communicate those things without treating people in ways that lower their sense of human dignity. And that's where I think we've lost track. It's fine that we don't all agree. It's fine that we continue to debate. But the idea that I don't have to treat you as a human being, that I can treat you as a subhuman because I disagree with you, that I find deplorable. It's unacceptable, and it has become okay in our society, and I think we need to do something about that immediately.
Now, so forgive me, but are you talking about sort of the fact that at the vigil there was this response? Or,
right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's the first thing, but I do think this other question of how you're allowed to treat people is a problem.
And how we teach
because
that to
how
young people, right.
We tell kids not to bully, but then we do things to each other that demonstrate that it's okay to treat people with less than basic respect. Mm-hmm. And I don't know these children. I don't know their families. But what I will say is, as a society, I am disappointed by the lack of respect that we show to each other on a daily basis.
I think it should be the parents that get punished in this situation, not the kids, because the kids are reacting by how they're taught, right? And so if you let them watch movies, if you have, you know, language, it's like going to a restaurant and you sit and you know your kids, even if they're not paying attention, they're paying attention to how you interact with the wait staff. Do you say, you know, may I please have this and thank you? And, you know, do you leave a mess? Do you just say, well, leave the, you know, Cheerios under the table and crunch them all up and climb on top of the table? Like, it's just basic manners. It's a really horrible thing that happened, but I think it's a testament to where society is right now.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what makes it even more shocking, right? Because I have so many reactions. I mean, one is kind of along the lines of what you guys were saying, and that is, again, we should say these are allegations. There is an investigation going on. Governor Sununu in New Hampshire has the Attorney General's office, the state Attorney General's office, looking into this as well. So, you know, an investigation will conclude whatever it concludes. And so, as you've said, there's questions that remain to be answered. But for a moment, let's just presume or hypothesize that what the parents say happened. What are they teaching their children? What are these parents teaching their children such that young people allegedly thought it was okay to put a rope around an 8-year-old's neck and push him off a table and let him swing there? I mean, it's beyond bullying. You know, it's something deeper and something more vicious that it's so deeply disturbing to me.
See, and I would say I don't know if it is that much beyond bullying, because it's adding a different motivation on top of why they're bullying. But, you know, there is a way in which, and I used to run a youth program, so I would hear crazy stories about things that kids were saying to each other, what was happening in bathrooms. This sense that you make yourself look better by having people underneath you, that is unfortunately sometimes the way things have come to work in our schools, in our society. Being on top of other people is unfortunately how too many people find their self-respect. So I do think, you know, like I said, I am saddened. But unfortunately, as someone who has worked in schools with young people and lives in the society, I'm not shocked. Well, disappointed, but not shocked.
So what about the other issue which I think is raised here? And that is that initially the young boy's mother was really upset with what she felt was a lack of assistance that she was getting from law enforcement, which is why she felt like she had to go public and posted those pictures of her son's, you know, terribly wounded neck on Facebook. Because according to her initial, well, actually, I should say NH1 reported that the police chief at Claremont first talked to them and said, well, you know, we got to be careful about the young people who are alleged to have done this because we don't want them to have a bad record following them for the rest of their lives. And of course, you got to think like, well, what about the little boy who was virtually lynched for, I mean, I struggle to even say that word out loud, but that's what happened.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that is also disappointing. And I think there's two pieces to this. One is there are ways to communicate to children that things are absolutely unacceptable. And I don't get the impression that would, like, so maybe there was some sort of punishment that happened, some sort of meeting, some sort of, to deal with these young people and not just say, well, we're going to wait around to the end of the investigation and then we'll see. You know, so I do think moving on this immediately is really important. Anybody who's a parent who knows if you have something that happens and you don't address it right away, you're sending the message that that was okay, right? So that's a problem. But I think it's also related to the reality that we have a hard time being honest about what is going on in our country. We have a hard time talking about race. And sometimes because people don't know how to handle it, the easiest thing is to pretend like it didn't happen. And that's a little bit of a human thing. When we don't know how to handle something, we try to just walk away.
Okay.
But it's also unacceptable.
So on that point, Jennifer, I'm going to come to you in a second. But on that point, kind of in a smaller way, the point that you're making, Mariama, I feel like it happened at Fenway Park here recently. And here's why. Because, of course, as we know, a group of fans at Fenway Park displayed a banner at Wednesday night's game. And they just dropped the banner on the Green Monster, and it said, racism is as American as baseball, okay? So pretty shocking thing to see in Fenway Park. And here's what two fans at the game said to Channel 5 that night.
I don't like mixing our politics with our sports. We come to places like this to kind of get away from that, escape from that, kind of unite. Sports tends to unite us more than anything else.
You don't expect it coming to Fenway, coming to a ball game like this. Boston is about love and coming together, not that.
So, I mean, I get what they're saying. Like, you go to Fenway Park, you want to see a baseball game and have a good time. But Jennifer, aren't there echoes in what those fans were saying in terms of what Mariama was saying? Like, we have a hard time talking about race. And I felt like those two fans captured it right then and there.
I mean, you know, so I guess I understand what those fans were talking about, because why then aren't we talking about gender and talking about that there's still a wage gap and that women are paid 87 cents on the dollar? I mean, where are the banners on that?
You might have just given someone an idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, hey, ladies, go and do that the next Patriots game, right? I mean, so, you know, why are women still cheerleaders?
Yeah, I would love, you want to join me? I'm down to do a banner around the cheerleaders because I'm a little annoyed.
So if we're going to open it up, then I don't think it's just racism. I'm going to go and say it's for gender. I'm going to go and say, you know, hey, all those single moms out there that are doing all the work and no one pays attention to them, they don't have any advances. Let's go talk about that. And let's go talk about the numbers of girls that are young women graduating from colleges that are over 50% women and still not getting paid the same amount. Women still don't have the same opportunities. People still, if you're going to apply to be in any club, any organization, are you married? Your marital status is still down there. Where's all that? So, I mean, I think, you know, there are lots of political issues to talk about. You know, maybe someone wants to talk about the wall. Maybe someone wants to talk about being deported, whatever it is. I just think that if we say it's okay for it to happen, what's going to happen is I think there's a little bit of use and enjoyment of it's a privilege to go to a game. It's not a right. To buy a ticket is a privilege. There's no constitutional right to buy a ticket. So go protest out on the street, because that's the place for it, out on the street. But inside, that's something that people earn the privilege to be there and to enjoy it, I think that there's a little bit of a separation there.
Mariama, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think it's complicated. I'm not sure how efficacious I think that was, but here's what I'll say. One, I don't think we should have to choose between one issue or the other. I'm a woman who experiences the pay gap. I'm also a Black person who experiences that. So there are plenty of issues. I don't think people should have to choose, and just because one wasn't highlighted, there's only so much you can fit on a banner, and so I'm okay with you choosing one issue, because how long would that banner have had to be with everything that should change? So I'm okay with that.
Housing costs.
Right. There's a lot of looks. I think here's where the challenge is, and I feel two ways about it. On one hand, yeah, I understand people want to go to the game. On the other hand, the reality is some of us have to live with it, and some people never, ever have to face it. And so there's this challenge where a lot of people get to opt into all these spaces where they're saying, oh, like, don't bring it to here. But then where do you have the conversation? Mm-hmm. So I do think people do need to have the conversation. I do think the Red Sox have some real historical things around issues of race.
Yeah, that's part of it.
I think that's part of the reason why it was selected. And I think the Red Sox, as an organization currently, I've been impressed with some of the things that they're doing. But I think the challenge for us is you don't move past things until you really move through things. And we haven't really moved through a lot of those things. And so I think there are attempts, and I think this was probably one of them, to try to get us to have a conversation that we're having a hard time having.
Yeah.
So I think I understand that people say, I just want to have a good time at the game. I get it. And at the same time, the reality is there is no space that actually is separated from these realities. Even down to that person selling you the hot dog, sometimes I want to know, are they being paid a good enough wage to be here? There's no separation from these issues that are life or death. So I think, you know, it's challenging.
Now, what I found interesting, though, was that picture. It looked like there were three white women holding the sign, too.
Which I actually think is great.
It was hysterical. I'm looking at the picture. I'm thinking, that's
I think that's important. I think it's as important for white people to say,
right,
we got some hard conversations to have.
Yeah.
And join me. It won't kill us. We'll actually come out on the other side, and we might be better people if we have them.
You know, we could actually spend the entire time talking about this, about these stories, because, you know, they're constant, and they are ones that we all are living and should be grappling with. But I do want to get to another part of the week's news.
Okay.
And Jennifer, you actually kind of inadvertently hinted at it, because it has to do with immigration and DACA. Because I have to say, I think I'm a little confused about what the president's position
Wait,
is right now.
Why would you be confused? What possibly would confuse you?
We know he met with Senator Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on Wednesday night. And here's what the president said to reporters yesterday before boarding, I should say, a very noisy Marine One.
We're working on a plan for DACA. People want to see that happen. You have 800,000 young people brought here, no fault of their own. So we're working on a plan. We'll see how it works out. But we're going to get massive border security as part of that.
Now, Nancy Pelosi spoke at a Capitol Hill press conference yesterday, and she said, actually, in her mind, the Democrats have come to a deal with the president.
We agreed to a plan to work out an agreement to protect our nation's dreamers from deportation. We insisted that the Bipartisan DREAM Act would be the basis for the protection and that we would review border security measures that do not include building a wall.
Okay. But then House Speaker Paul Ryan, right after that, held a press conference of his own, and he said, no deal yet.
We have not begun negotiations. What we're doing is talking with ourselves here in our majority to make sure that we are all on the same page ourselves before we proceed on all of these things. And it's right and proper that the president talks with the other party. These were discussions, not negotiations. There isn't an agreement.
Jennifer, deal or no deal?
Honestly, it's keeping all of us really intrigued, I have to say, right? I mean, the good thing is all of this makes more people interested in politics on both sides.
Because we have no choice. Nobody
knows
what's
going
on.
We're not really sure where it's going. So I would say this. Trump currently seems to, and I don't know if he does or not because I'm not in his head, thank God, but the president seems to severely dislike the Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan.
I was like, are you saying Republican leadership?
He seriously dislikes a lot of Republicans right now. So
a lot of Republicans dislike him, too.
Yes.
I mean, wasn't it Ann Coulter who just tweeted, yeah, here it is, put a fork in Trump. At this point, who doesn't want Trump impeached?
Yes.
I mean, if you've lost Ann Coulter, you've lost conservative Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely still know a couple of them. and some might actually be related to me. Scary enough. But I think, you know, Trump had to play footsie with the Democrats, right? Trump, whether he knows it or not, I think General Kelly understands that politics is a numbers game. All you need are the numbers in your favor. If he goes to Pelosi and to Schumer, has a conversation with them about, you know, how do you get to keep what you want to keep? And maybe I don't, but I can work something else in there. And I know there are a couple of moderates that will vote with you guys because they keep voting with you guys anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we do that? And, you know, they're more than happy to get what they want. And there's no wall. There was never going to be a wall. That was the biggest scam out there. We're going to build a wall. We're not building a wall. We have no money to build a wall. Mexico's not paying for it. So, you know, and by the way, you're also not sending back all of these people. That's the other thing you're also not doing. So everyone knew that from the very beginning, except for the people that voted for him and really thought that he was going to send people back, round them up, send them back.
That's not an insignificant number of people, though.
No, not insignificant. Yeah, right? But now they're dwindling because his numbers are in the mid-30s. And so, I think that there probably is a deal on DACA, and he absolutely needs to get a win in his column.
Uh-huh.
And the easiest thing for him right now is to say, okay, we can keep the Dreamers Act and maybe make some tweaks to it. So maybe his tweaks are that the kids who are here can't be sponsors of their parents.
Right.
But he had to get something, but he didn't get anything as big as the wall in exchange for that.
Mariama?
Well, you know, I remember when MTV came out with the reality TV show The Real World, and I don't think they should have gotten to use that title because I feel like that's what we're living in. I'm just waiting for the commercial break. You get one tweet at 6:11, and before you can digest it, you've got another tweet 15 seconds later that seems different than what you just read. I don't know how to translate that or understand that. But I will say it would be funny if it weren't also sad.
Well, at least with the DACA part, there's 800,000 young people who are wondering what's going to happen.
There's the question of young people's fate, and then for me, there's even the deeper piece, which is, you know, integrity, like your word needs to be your word. And I get that, like, there are different interpretations, but it does start to get problematic when you feel like you can't tell one minute to the next what somebody just said. So that, you know, I want us to get to a point, like, and even if I disagree with you, I generally would like to understand that your yay is yay and your nay is nay.
Especially if you're president of the United States.
That's my
funny
hope.
Part. I mean, because, you know, you kind of look at, if you want to dumb down politics a little bit and you want to look at the president of the United States as the parent, right? This is the person who's setting the course and showing you the path to go down, and then says, you're grounded. You can go to that party. But no, you can't go to that party. I never said you could go to that party. You have to stay at home. But no, now you can go. Just for a little bit, right? And so it's like, how confusing does it end up being? The people I feel worse for are Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, because those two are just sitting there with all these members breathing down their necks. They have no idea what's going on because they have an erratic president who can't make up his mind and make a decision. And
I gotta say, I 100% do not feel bad for them.
Well,
mostly because, you know, not in terms of like what the president has done since he became president, but he is exactly the same as he was today as he was during the entire campaign.
Well,
and that is true.
I don't think either of those guys ever wanted Trump to be president. And again, can't speak for them. I have no idea. But I have to say that when you are the top dogs, and then you have someone who comes in above you and screws up all the work you're trying to do, it has to be a little bit frustrating. And they knew that that was going to happen. They knew that they had someone who, he's a businessman. He's going to act in his best interest. He's not going to act in, and he, as far as I'm concerned, he's not a real Republican. He's never been a real Republican. He became a Republican 9 years ago. He belonged to the other side. He just happened to come to our side because that's where he thought that he could win. And
there's only one side. There's his side.
There's the Trump side.
Yeah, and the one thing true. I will say is consistently throughout his life, he's always been the most important person to himself. So I think the larger point, I guess, for me, and as I know folks who are directly affected by this, people are making life choices without understanding where right. their lives are going.
Exactly.
And so I hope they have some kind of deal that is clear and is soon, because leaving people in limbo is just wrong.
It is. You know, this is the first time in a week in review where we have run out of time for hubbubs, which is actually a good thing, because all of us have had kind of a tumultuous couple of first weeks of September. So I'm going to give us all a break, right? Jennifer Nassour, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mariama White Hammond, Reverend Mariama White Hammond at the Bethel AME Church in JP. Reverend Hammond, White Hammond, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
It's a great week in review. We'll be back with more Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about dark money in Massachusetts politics. It's still pretty dark in places, but there's the occasional ray of light. Take the news from earlier this week that the state's Office of Campaign Finance levied its largest ever penalty, more than $425,000, on a dark money organization that was a massive player in last year's battle over ballot question 2. That was the proposal to raise the charter school cap in the state. Now, you'll recall that question 2 was the most expensive ballot question in state history, more than $40 million spent by both sides. And $19 million of that came from Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, a group connected to the New York-based pro-charter Families for Excellent Schools. Well, it turns out that Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, or FESA, was required to disclose its donors. It did not. The state's campaign finance watchdog has forced that disclosure, and we now know that about $15 million of those funds came from approximately 40 individuals, including Amos Hostetter, the former cable television businessman from Boston, Seth Klarman, chief executive of the Baupost Group, and other hedge fund executives, and Paul Sagan, chair of the state's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education. Well, joining us now is Michael Sullivan. He is the director of the Massachusetts Office of Campaign and Political Finance. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So first of all, this is a historic fine, I guess, and a violation. $426,000, the largest in state history.
Let me clarify what a fine is, because everybody wants to call it a fine or a penalty. We don't have the ability to fine. It was a negotiated agreement. What that number represents is all of the money that was on hand in the FESA account as of whatever date, it was July 31st of this year.
Yeah.
Essentially shut down the bank account, dissolve the C4, and be done with it.
Wow. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts gets that money.
No, it certainly doesn't go to my budget.
Where does it go?
Goes to the Commonwealth's general fund.
General fund.
Yeah. We've in these agreements that we've done for disclosure issues, the last few years, we've raised $1.2 million.
Huh. Yeah. How unusual is it for something like this to happen in the course of an election or a ballot question?
In a ballot question, I think it's very unusual. In the time that I've been there, this is only the second time we've dealt with a ballot question in dark money. The first time was actually with the casino question that they tried to bring more casinos to Suffolk Downs after the first round. And we ended up doing a disposition agreement with some folks they said they were from Delaware, but they really weren't.
And you've been doing this for 23, 24 years?
23 years.
So in all that time, the ballot questions, the contributions for ballot questions have been named.
As far as we know, you know, the thing about ballot questions is that anybody can give and there are no limits. So it's all about disclosure. So for the most part, over the years, our auditing process has been, yeah, this looks pretty good. There's a lot of names. There's a lot of individuals, a lot of companies. It doesn't look like it's coming from any one source.
Okay. But so just so we're clear on the law in Massachusetts, like you said, for ballot questions, anybody can give and there are no limits. So individuals can give publicly, you know, $5 million if they wanted to.
Absolutely.
But in this case, that is not what happened.
That's not what happened.
So describe to us what exactly did Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy do wrong that was in violation of Massachusetts campaign finance laws?
Well, I think you have to go back and sort of look at the history of what they were doing before the question came up. And FESA, which is what we call them, early on was being funded by FES. And the vast majority of the money coming into that account was from the 501c3 and from a couple of donors, and that was it. We looked from August 2015 through the end of 16. And what happened is in July, when the question was certified for the ballot, the flow of money began, and it was from individuals primarily. Only two individuals had given from August of 15 through June of 16.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, individuals started giving pretty quickly and in pretty heavy amounts.
And the investigation found that as individuals gave money to FESA, that it was within a very short period of time that almost identical dollar values were then going to the ballot question committee?
Large dollar values, not always identical,
okay.
But they were close enough for us to draw that conclusion.
Yeah. So ultimately, your office determined that they should have been behaving like a question committee. So what exactly does that mean, though?
Well, what we determined is they should have been acting like a ballot question committee. And whether or not they explicitly said to people, come support this ballot question committee, that was their intent. That was what they were doing. And the timing of when they were doing it and the amounts in which they were doing it with were so enormous that you could draw no other conclusion than that they were a ballot question committee.
Okay.
And that those donors should be, you know, disclosed publicly to everybody. There was a lot of press last year about this, and we watched it pretty closely. We actually opened a case right after the election. This has taken 10 months.
Okay. How does an investigation like this work? What gets it started off? I mean, you said you were watching question two pretty closely. But.
Well, there were a lot of media stories, but honestly, with investigations, when you look at reports and things, there's a three-word phrase I use, trust your gut.
Yeah.
I've been doing this a while. I can look at a report. So can most of my staff. They've all been there a while. We can look at a report and sort of get a feel for it. So you trust your gut. We have subpoena power, so we've learned to use that judiciously. We do all of our investigations under grand jury secrecy, so we don't discuss it.
And you need that standard because you're dealing with finances and probably banks and financial stuff. And
I have a newspaper article on a bulletin board over my desk that says, oops, doesn't cut it when man's reputation is ruined. So you want to make sure that if you're going to do these investigations that you get it right.
Yeah.
And that's the key.
So there was some indication that even during the election that made you want to watch closely what was happening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were watching, but we needed to wait for the election to be over. Under our statute, our big power is to refer something to the Attorney General, but we can't refer to the Attorney General within 120 days of the election.
I got it.
So it's like a blackout period.
So how does this differ, though, from all the money that went into the No on Two side? Because lots of that money, the majority of it, came from teachers' unions.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how does that differ from what Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy was doing?
The teachers union was using money from their dues, from the dues that they collect from their members. So that money was raised for a general purpose, and they have a bank account with money in it for a general purpose. I'm assuming that's what they used to fund it. So they didn't raise the money for the ballot question.
Mm-hmm.
They were general funds that they had.
And you were also talking about how regarding Families for Excellent Schools Advocacy, that the timing was really important.
The timing was key.
Okay.
That was the whole key to this.
So this disposition agreement calls for a couple of interesting things. Like one is that FESA has now been entirely dissolved, doesn't
mm-hmm.
exist anymore.
Correct.
Why was that necessary?
It's just part of the negotiation.
Okay, but they were willing to do it.
They were willing to do it.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, when we get down to negotiating, what you should realize is that we're trying to come to an agreement. If we don't come to an agreement, we still have the opportunity to send this to the Attorney General. So there's a big incentive, I think, for most folks who are dealing with us to try to do an agreement.
Okay. So the umbrella organization, though, Families for Excellent Schools, still exists.
Apparently, yeah.
But you've also, in part of the agreement, is that they won't be involved in Massachusetts elections for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How unusual is that to be part of a disposition agreement?
It's something we've talked to with people. We've done a number of disclosure cases, mostly in candidate cases. And oftentimes we put that on the table for folks to say, listen, why don't you just take a little break for a while? You know, you've had a problem. You're going to take a little break and then you can come back after a while if you want to. And that's kind of what we put out here on the table. And they accepted that.
Fascinating. Okay, so here's what I guess people really want to know. This ballot question was so contentious
mm-hmm.
in Massachusetts. In a way, maybe it's not surprising that there was a lot of dark money involved. But I suppose for the sake of our democracy, is there a way for us to get to a place where this can be stopped before an election actually happens?
Well, I think you probably have to ask the Supreme Court that. We've had Citizens United. What the Supreme Court did say in Citizens United was that disclosure was good, but we're not seeing that in practice. And so that's right now, that's kind of where our efforts are geared towards, is just making sure that people disclose what they do. And part of the importance of this discussion and this agreement is to get the word out. Mm-hmm. Make sure people understand, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so are there regulations in Massachusetts that could be strengthened?
Well, I think we did a pretty good job in this case. Our regulations are great. Our general counsel, Greg Byrne, does an awesome job with our regulations, and we have wide latitude in doing our regulations. In this case, we stole a regulation from California that had a similar case like this about 3 or 4 years ago. And our regulation basically talked about the timing and the amount and how you can draw no other conclusion than these donations were made for the ballot question.
Yeah. Mike Sullivan, if we could, let's just take a little step back, because you have been doing this for 23, 24 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you sound incredulous at that.
Not that I'm incredulous. It's just that, like, you have a really unique perspective on how money and politics have changed over that time. So first of all, what got you into this?
You know, I grew up in Lynn, and I worked for a state rep as an intern when I was in college. And I went to my first fundraiser, and I thought, wow, this is kind of interesting. Look who's showing up. Look who's giving money. I wonder how this all works. And I've just always been interested in it ever since then. I had planned to do my thesis on this issue. I've always kept an eye on it. And when the opportunity came to apply for this job, I was on it.
Wow. And so, but it's a job that you have to be appointed by the governor?
No, it's really unique. You're appointed by a four-person panel, and it's called the Commission to Select the Director. It is the dean of a law school who's appointed to the commission by the governor. It's the Secretary of State. It's the chairman of the Republican Party and the chairman of the Democratic Party, and it has to be a unanimous appointment, and it's for 6 years.
I see. So it's a bipartisan selection, mm-hmm. then. And mm-hmm. you've been in this position with Republican Democratic governors as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so how have things changed with money and politics in that time? Because I feel like, again, just at the risk of repeating myself, with question two, we reached a new level in Massachusetts in terms of the amount of money coming in for not even a political office.
Yeah, certainly the money has increased tremendously, and the way the money gets to the election has increased. What we're proud of on our side, blow our own horn a little bit, is the ability that we have to get that information out quickly. Everyone files electronically. When I started, it was all paper. If you wanted to see a report, you came into our office, you asked for a file, you sat down, you took notes, you made a photocopy. Now the data is all out there instantaneously. It's searchable, sortable, you name it. You can export it. You can do whatever you want with it. And I think that's allowed people to see what's going on to the extent that the disclosure is good. When the disclosure is not good, that's when we come into the game and try to make sure that it's a little better.
Do you think this kind of watchdog is more necessary now than ever?
Oh, yeah. The amounts of money are just enormous. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, these agencies were created in the mid-70s after Watergate. And, money's like water. It's going to go somewhere. And our job is to make sure that everybody knows how it got to where it's going.
Yeah. Do you worry about how much money has an influence in politics?
You know, I'm the referee. So it's sort of hard to worry about that. It sort of goes to my avocation. I'm a football official. And in college football, pass interference can be no more than 15 yards. And in the pros, it can be the spot foul, it can be 50 yards. If you ask me to ref the college game, I'm going to do it with 15. If you ask me to ref the pro game, I'm going to do it with 60. It doesn't really matter what I think. It matters what the statute says.
Okay. Very diplomatic and wise answer.
I've practiced that one.
But just to reiterate, so in case people didn't know, four ballot questions in Massachusetts. You can mm-hmm. give unlimited amounts, but you got to put your name on it.
Correct.
All right. Well, Michael Sullivan is the director of the Office of Campaign and Political Finance. A real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And I should note, we did reach out for an interview or with an interview request for Families for Excellent Schools. They sent us this statement that said, quote, "Though we believe we complied with all laws and regulations during the campaign, we worked closely with the OCPF to resolve this matter so we could move forward with our mission of working alongside families desperate for better schools," end quote.
Now, we here at Radio Boston covered the question of dark money and the 2016 election rather extensively last year, and we have gone through our website and dug up all the links to those conversations because I know you're dying to hear them again. So we put them all at our website. Check them out at radioboston.org. And guess what, everyone? We get to do it all again next year. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're headed to the much-beloved landscape of Martha's Vineyard. Recently, our producer, Allison Bruzek, she really took one for the team and spent an entire day on the spectacular vineyard with David Foster. He's the director of the Harvard Forest, and he's published a new natural history of the island called A Meeting of Land and Sea, Nature and the Future of Martha's Vineyard. Together, they toured some of Foster's favorite spots to talk about how Martha's Vineyard was shaped and how to best protect it.
Passengers, bicyclists, you're next.
Driving in his silver Prius, David Foster and I are taking a ferry to the island off the southeast coast of Martha's Vineyard, Chappaquiddick. He wants to show me, in a most dramatic fashion, the importance of looking at the history of a place to understand its future. We're headed to Waysquey Point, home to some of the fastest rates of erosion on the eastern seaboard.
Look at the fog, though. Marvelous. So we'd want to get within about 4 feet.
Just beyond the fog, we can see the barrier beach. It's a strip of sand that barely crests out of the water and runs parallel to the shore. The ridge protects the cliff we're standing on, for now.
We're standing on a 25 to 30 foot tall kind of wall of sand looking down at the beach. So the water used to wash right up against this and just undermine it. This is just pure sand. And so every time a wave hit it, it just crumbled. So the beach now protects the bluff, but you can still see the evidence of the big trees that have fallen from the bluff. When the barrier beach breaks and when there's a big storm, this kind of beach disappears overnight. So it's completely ephemeral. Looks so permanent, so solid, but water washes it away in nothing.
The ocean takes 3 to 5 feet of the South Shore on average each year, and it was a hard lesson learned for the area's most notorious piece of architecture, the Shifter House.
So this house used to be right there on the very edge of the bluff. It's an immense house. It's something on the order of 8,000 square feet. So it was quite a feat to move that whole thing. So that house was built in a place that it should never have been allowed if people had paid good attention to the historical understanding out here. They would have realized how vulnerable it was. Hundreds of feet of coastline receded backwards and eroded. It's pure sand going down about 20 feet on that bluff. So it was very easy to erode.
Foster says the shifters, their planners and engineers, and everyone who approved the house took too short a view of history. Had they looked back centuries to work done by coastal topographer Henry Whiting, they would have seen records calling Waysquey one of the most quickly eroding spots on the northeastern coast. And that same history now points to more powerful hurricanes.
The people who built the houses here, the boards that allowed them to build the houses here, they were surprised by the erosion. People will be surprised by the next hurricane because we could easily have hurricanes that are much more powerful than anybody has ever experienced, because we know that the 20th century hurricanes that affected Martha's Vineyard were modest in comparison to the ones that occurred here in the 19th century and especially the 17th century. So we might be less surprised if we spent more time looking at history.
And ultimately, Foster says, based on history, we know what will happen to the Shifter House.
The beach will move to to the north, and all the property that this fellow owns will be lost.
It's sobering context for the future, and something Foster wants people to keep in mind. Back in his car, we drive to a place with a much happier conclusion, and one of his favorite places on the island.
You want me to give away my favorite spot?
Okay, I won't entirely reveal the location, but he describes our setting.
We're standing here right adjacent to the old Indian burial ground on Chappaquiddick, overlooking Cape Pogue Bay. We can see the lighthouse off in the distance.
It's a beautiful scene. The blues of the water set against the bright greens of lush island vegetation. But Foster likes it for more than its beauty. It's one of the island's great conservation stories. He points toward the pasture land and brush to our left.
Out in front of us is, in a sense, one of the future directions for conservation, which is conservation is not just protecting intact sites, it's managing sites so that they become even more beneficial for nature and for people.
It used to be dotted with houses. Now it's thriving flora.
The tendency in affluent places is to conserve nature or conserve old farmland and just try to hold it as it is and not use it at all and kind of freeze nature. Well, you can't freeze nature to begin with, but all that landscape actually used to produce food or timber or whatever. At the same time, we want to eat well and we want to live in wooden houses and have beautiful wooden desks and furniture and so on. So the wood and the products have to come from someplace. And so we can learn much more about conserving better and then utilizing nature to our advantage, but in ways that respect nature.
Our last stop on the tour is a woods preserve next to the main road that winds around the vineyard.
This is one of the big intact forest areas on the island.
Here, Foster wants to show me the ways in which nature can and will continue to cope without humans intervening.
There was this outbreak 3 years in a row of a native caterpillar that defoliated the oaks, and then in the third year there was a drought and all the trees died. I mean, literally across the entire ridge, all the trees died. And since then, the trees have gradually lost all their branches and lost all their bark and are starting to fall over. And at the same time, there's been this absolutely phenomenal resurgence of young growth, of new saplings, of sprouts, of new seedlings. And in the intervening time, all the plants that were in the understory, all of the blueberries and huckleberries and all the seeds that were in the soil, like raspberries, have all just flourished. And so there's been this incredible kind of banquet of berries in what was a forest. And so it's a perfect example of the way that nature copes with what we would perceive as a disaster or as just incredible damage to the landscape.
I asked Foster about what's going to happen as the effects of climate change continue, and he surprises me.
Climate change impacts so far are relatively subtle. They're shifts in the timing of vegetation greening up of particular species, and their population changes through the year, the time that they arrive, the times that they breed, and things like that. And those are relatively subtle in comparison to these massive changes that have occurred by direct human activity of building houses and so on. And so it's going to be a long time before climate change has an impact that is commensurate with that.
He says the hands-off approach for humans is the best way to allow the vineyard to thrive in the future.
As climate change impacts happen, as we have hurricanes, as we have insects that are defoliating forests or altering other types of vegetation, nature is actually remarkably resilient, but it's only resilient if we keep it intact.
That story from Radio Boston's Allison Bruzek. She spoke with David Foster, director of the Harvard Forest at Harvard University. His new book is A Meeting of Land and Sea, Nature and the Future of Martha's Vineyard. They began their beautiful conversation in Chappaquiddick and ended in West Tisbury. And that's where we're going to end this week's Radio Boston. So have a lovely weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.